It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Yeah, my name's Chuck Tanner. I'm the research director at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. And I got into this work in the early 90s, tracking white supremacist organizations, doing field investigations for the Center for Democratic Renewal that was based in Atlanta and Kansas City. And so investigating Klan, neo-Nazi, Christian identity, Christian patriots that we called at the time. I later worked for the Coalition for Human Dignity in Portland, doing similar work, also started to look at organized anti-Indian movement, more groups that want to terminate tribes, abrogate treaties, and really just end tribal nationhood. I later worked on that through a group called Borderlands Research, a small group that focused on the anti-Indian activism. And then about 2013, started working with the Institute in different capacities. And had worked with Leonard Zuskind, the founder of the Institute, an encyclopedia of knowledge and experience when it comes to dealing with these movements. And had worked with him back in CDR as well, and then started working with the Institute, doing research and writing, and got to where I am now, trying to expose white nationalists of a range of far-right kinds of groups that are pose a fundamental threat to democracy in terms of, and that incorporate bigotry and racism as core aspects of their organizing. So that's me in a nutshell.
Thanks again for coming on. And just another plug, if you want to go back in the It's Going Down archives, you can actually hear interviews with Leonard Zuskind we did a couple years ago, based broadly on his foundational book, which is amazing. You recommend it to everybody. Blood and Politics, White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstreams. If you haven't read that book, I highly recommend it. It's, I feel, fundamental in understanding both the far right and kind of the interplay between auxiliary fascist and far right reactionary groups and the state itself. But today we're going to be talking kind of broadly about two things. There is a fight brewing in Southern Oregon in the Klamath Basin around essentially tribal water rights and far-right groups which are seeking to kind of intervene in that and are pushing to gain access to water. And one of those groups is the People's Rights Network, which is headed by Ammon Bundy, who, of course, was involved in the Malheur occupation in 2016. And we're kind of going to get into all those bits and pieces. And you all have been sort of tracking all this stuff and writing about it, and it's been kind of flying under the radar, I feel like, in a lot of ways. And we're just going to kind of highlight a lot of the work that you've been doing and kind of bring it to people's attention. So just to dive into it, let's just start off and talk about the current situation in Southern Oregon with the People's Rights Network and the broader issue surrounding water access. Just kind of like tell us, like, what is the tension happening there and what is the main issue that's causing all this controversy?
Yeah, I mean, there's two kind of components to it. One, there's the broader context that's happening in southern Oregon and that impacts the Klamath River Basin that extends down to California. And then there's what People's Rights has tried to do to insert itself into that. And it's a longstanding issue in the area that's been heightened by the extreme drought that folks are experiencing. And as a result of low water volumes and in the context of the Endangered Species Act and tribes having a senior water right in the area, water for irrigation has been cut off. Now the federal government is provided some support, and there's still concerns about well water draws off being drawn off that could affect the water table that that are largely unregulated. But there's difficulties in the in the farming community up there. Tribes though throughout the length of the Klamath Basin are also facing water shortages. The Klamaths are facing low water levels in Lake Klamath, which is critical for two species of suckerfish that they have long relied on and that are reserved in treaties, in their treaty. Tribes in the lower Klamath Basin, such as the Karuk and the Yurok, are facing massive fish die-offs and parasitic infestations, partly as a product of low water levels and the lack of a flush down south. The Hoopa Valley tribe, the Resgini Rancheria are also impacted by these. And the tribes with the Western Water Law that pegged water rights to the first time that water was used for beneficial use, the tribes have a prior right. They have senior water rights. And for their fisheries dated to actually time immemorial, since they have, fished this basin for many, many years. And the feds really helped create this problem in the 1990s when they irrigated the high desert through the arrogance of the Bureau of Reclamation that did this without regard to treaty rights, practices that came on the heels of horrific genocides in California against tribes, wars against the Modocs, which are part of the Klamath tribes, Klamath termination, just a number of things set in motion throughout this entire process that disregarded the fundamental and inherent rights of tribes. This blew up in 2001 when folks, in the community broke in and reopened the spigots to Canal A for irrigation, which in violation of the law at that time. So it's been a longstanding problem in the region, and barring some significant effort there to change things, is going to be a recurring problem. Into this mix, Amon Bundy and People's Rights inserted themselves, beginning several months ago, back in March and April, they started getting this on their radar, in their Central Oregon chapter in particular, and then their Klamath chapter. And they inserted themselves into this mix, working closely with a guy named Grant Knoll, who sits on the Klamath Irrigation District Board, which is a kind of quasi-municipal body that manages the irrigation system. And they have come in and made repeated threats that they're going to violate the law and open up the spigots for irrigation, which would, trample on the water and treaty rights of the tribes in up and down the length of the basin, and which could potentially lead to another kind of armed standoff of the kind that Bundy and his family have engaged in. His dad in 2014 and him in 2016 down in Mount Heer. They've repeatedly said, both Grant Knoll and Amon Bundy, that they're gonna do this, that they're just gonna seize the facility and open the spigots, for farmers in abject violation tribal water rights. So that's, in a nutshell, 100 or so years of Klamath Water Basin and Bundy and his group now injecting themselves into it and bringing all the mess of bigotry and far-right ideology that they have into the mix. And so we're very concerned about it, very concerned about their role in it. That's kind of what we've been focused on because we've been tracking his organization for a while. The good thing is they haven't gotten the kind of traction in the broader community that folks had when they breached the canal in 2001. And so we're doing everything we can to let folks know what they're about and to keep them marginalized in this situation so that they don't get to define it. But it's always a concern with his group. He's got a philosophy of using armed force to advance his politics. And so we're, keeping an eye on it and trying to continue to expose what they're up to down there.
You know, it's interesting. We had Devin Burghardt from your organization on here right before the election, and we were talking about the possibility of far-right meddling in the election. Of course, we had no idea, of course, what lay on January 6th. You know, we were talking about Proud Boys coming and trying to harass people at the polls and stuff. But, you know, one of the things that he said, which I thought was just so right on, is he said kind of the far-right coalitions that you all were seeing in the future forming were sort of around, like, anti-mask stuff or kind of COVID conspiracies.
Yeah.
And then, like, lo and behold, Ammon Bundy kind of like puts together the People's Rights Network that really comes out of that. So let's spend some time now and talk about the People's Rights Network and just like what it is and like who are these people that are part of it, because I feel like it's kind of like the big far right group that a lot of people just haven't heard of.
The idea for it formed somewhere between Malheur and late 2019, early 2020. For an organization as an umbrella for Bundy's style politics. And it really gets organizing in earnest in early 2020 around COVID restrictions that they cast as tyrannical violations of individual rights. And Bundy has even compared the experience of having to wear a mask at Costco to what it was like to be a Jewish in 1930s Germany. You know, we've seen those kind of rampant, you know, really anti-Semitic kinds of comparisons. And so those have been their main issues that they focused on. Putting forward this threat to individual rights has been kind of their prominent articulation of what's going on. But if you look at this organization and doesn't take a lot of poking to see what we're really dealing with here is a brand of very far-right nationalism. They build a national identity around a mix of kind of founders, mythologies, extremely distorted versions of the Constitution, religious nationalism. Bundy's in particular has been shaped by W. Cleon Skousen from National Center for Constitutional Studies, coming out of far-right Mormonism, although what they've built is really a cross-denominational kind of religious nationalism. Their group has a really kind of vehement denial that racism is a factor in American society, which we're seeing at fairly broad levels, even beyond Bundy's group. They draw on ideas from the Posse Comitatus of the 70s and 80s, and a kind of libertarian styled individualism and a gun rights fetishism are elements of their ideology. Just to give an example of how radical their assault on civil rights is, one of their leading constitutional theorists is Chris Ann Hall, this Florida-based activist, attorney herself, but she puts on her puts forward her own kind of self-styled constitutionalism. Well, under Hall's framework, she believes that the 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, and the 19th Amendments are unconstitutional overreaches of national government. Under that framework that she wants to push forward, if that were enacted, it would absolutely gut the federal basis of civil rights laws. 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law, 15th, voting, ending voting, or setting up a legal framework to end voter discrimination based on race, which we're still seeing as a fight, and the 19th Amendment, the right of women to vote. The end game that Bundy and his crowd would bring about, if you look at the logic of their ideology, would be to gut federal and state capacity to enforce civil rights, to gut any capacity of government to address racial, gender, economic inequality, and would integrate some sort of posse-style enforcement of their version of the Constitution at the local level. One of their activists even going so far as saying that he would like to replace the police with militias, with their militias, and that he longs to see Antifa being shot all day. So those are kind of some of the, you know, and they see their enemies as demonic and rooted in their kind of Christian variety of nationalism. So it's really kind of a, you know, you look at what they want, it's really kind of a nightmare scenario that, you know, most of us don't want to live in. And they've got a very paramilitary political approach to how they bring it about. And
I just feel that people kind of just brush this kind of segment of the far right aside, especially the media, and like labeling them like, quote, anti-government, which is, yeah. I mean, I like how you all write about it and say, like, they're not anti-government. They're like for like a very specific like state organization. And like you said, I mean, the Oath Keepers are pretty much in this vein as well, kind of like, yeah, a post posse comitatus.
It's the stuff of death squads is a concern that we have when you look at how they frame things. And you're referencing the posse is absolutely right on. I mean, even back in the 90s, we really didn't buy the framework that these groups were just fundamentally, philosophically anti-government in some way. They want to be the government. And even back in the 90s when there was the Freeman standoff in 96, I think it was, in Montana, Christian identity believers, so identity being a pseudo, virulently racist pseudo-religion, holds that white people are the Israelites of the Bible, Jews are satanic imposters, people of color, an inferior mud race, you know, a radically white supremacist and really a kernel of the tributary that would become white nationalism. When they set up a standoff in Montana in 96, we kind of looked at that and talked about it as the kernel of the white Christian republic that they wanted to create. They want to be the government, and that stands true for Bundy's group. They engage in a whole range of political activities. They've been recruiting people to run for office. They've been lobbying. They've been protesting. They've been showing up at, particularly in Central Oregon, where they're most strongly built out, showing up at city meetings, lobbying state legislators, wanting to shape the government by engaging with it, but always in the back, if you look at their rhetoric and some of their organizational planning, with an eye to some sort of armed confrontation and even far-right revolution if they don't get what they want through engaging the government. And this posse idea has played an important part of that. So, you know, we never really, even back in the 90s, anti-government didn't seem to fit them. They were not philosophically wanting to get rid of states writ large. They wanted to become the state. And, you know, and as you mentioned, this posse idea is One of the ideas that came out of the posse was that the sheriff was the highest law of the land.
Right.
Critical in enforcing the Constitution. And if the sheriff didn't enforce the Constitution as they understood it, they could enforce the law through the posse against the sheriff.
Yeah, I just kind of want to make that, you know, point, because it's not like they're not anarchists. They're not proposing, like, some right. sort of, like, you know, an extension of direct democracy or freedom towards outside of state authority, or even like a libertarian aspect where it's just like, we don't want that. We want markets or something. They literally want to have like an extreme version of state authority on a different level. And I think one other point to point out is, and we really saw this in the protests that erupted around the gun laws in Virginia, is that, you know, it's easy to kind of brush these people aside, as like gun nuts or whatever. But I mean, they have deep connections with a lot of sheriffs through like, constitutional sheriff's networks and stuff. I mean, you can look at people like, Sheriff Clark, who originally was going to be part of the Trump administration and then was either pushed out or decided not to do it. But I mean, he has extensive links to the Oath Keepers. I mean, these are people with real institutional power and, you know, backing and networks and stuff. And there are definitely large sections of law enforcement that are definitely in support of this idea of like the constitutional sheriff, or the sheriff being like the head honcho,
yep.
and like having direct links with these militia movements.
Absolutely. And People's Rights has built some of those relationships. The Klamath County sheriff has made some statements indicating sympathies with them. Bob Songer, who's Klickitat County, Washington sheriff, appeared at a People's Rights meeting in Southern Washington where he was praised and got a big round of applause, and you could tell from the video he was reveling in it. Chris Ann Hall, their main constitutional theorist, and I'm doing that with air quotes, has built relationships with police. She was just photographed with on the official page of an Idaho County sheriff. The county's escaping me right now. But that's an active part of what they want to do, is they want to build that kind of institutional support for their long-term political goals and recruit sheriffs that might intervene to try to block having to follow a gun regulation, some regulation of private property. They have a really deep kind of private property fetish in their ideology as well. And they want to, you know, build political power so that they can do the things they want to do on the ground. And that's, you know, sheriffs wouldn't even have to participate in some of their more potentially violent actions if they just give them a little cover. And I think that they, you know, recognize that kind of thing and want to build that kind of base of support in local level police institutions. They've had a sheriff and a couple of police officers come and speak at their meetings in Southern Oregon as well.
How did the People's Rights Network and Bundy, how did they kind of appear on the scene in this ongoing tension that's been happening in the Klamath Basin?
First thing was really building up People's Rights, and partly Bundy's stature coming out of Malheur and the connection to his dad's standoff in 2014 and their success at you know, really not being held accountable legally, and federal repeated, I don't know what to call it, federal ineptitude in dealing with these folks legally, really built their stature and empowered them and got a sense that, you know, they could move forward and build a political movement. Some of the early people's rights leaders that we saw went back to supporting his dad's 2014 standoff. Some of them were actually involved in the Malheur standoff as well, or started to engage in the trials that came after that. So through the stature that he built up, he was able to start to flesh out a network. And when we did our first report about 7 months ago, they had it was over 150 kind of official local leaders and a membership of over 20,000. That's much higher, and we're gonna get back to assessing that as well. So Bundy's stature coming out of the things that he had engaged in played a significant role in building out in filling out their kind of institutional structure as an organization. We've seen the same thing in Oregon that's led up to this current situation, particularly in the four states just above Klamath County, or four states, the four, they might want them to be four states, but they're not yet. Four counties above Klamath County, where they've got about 2,000 members that were built up through the same kind of COVID activism that they had engaged in initially. Over the course between the time that we wrote the initial report on Amon's army and the turn, or early parts of this, of 2021, they really built out an infrastructure in Central Oregon, as well through both recruiting people, through building alliances with their other organizations. They've built some alliances with Tea Party groups. They have completely integrated anti-vaccination activism into their repertoire. They have engaged with a couple Posse Comitatus style groups. They built a relationship with Oregon's for Medical Freedom, an anti-vaxxer group. And they built local business relationships, both supporting businesses that wanted to defy COVID restrictions and kind of badgering businesses that wanted to follow the restrictions and keep their employees safe, mask wearing and things like that. And so this infrastructure gets built out in Central Oregon. And then about March, they start seeing this water situation unfold and start to insert themselves in that. They're much stronger in Central Oregon. They've only got about 200 members in Klamath County in there, you know, which is still too many. They haven't built out the base in Klamath County that they have up in the central part of the state. So I think that partly accounts for why you haven't seen the broader mobilizations or in support of them, at least as of yet. They started, you could see early on, they started talking about this water crisis in similar terms that they used to talk about COVID and anti-vaxxer issues, in terms of being an infringement on private property, in restricting individual rights. And they started to fold their activism in Central Oregon in support of what their allies were doing in Klamath County, where this water conflict is located. And so there's been a process that stretches back to Malheur and building up a national infrastructure, a state infrastructure, and then across the course of 2020 and much of this, especially this year, building out that infrastructure in Central Oregon and starting to in Southern Oregon, that led up to them now feeling like they've got the clout to insert themselves into this really difficult situation in the Klamath Basin. So it's been a process.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show.
I wondered if you could just talk about how Bundy has kind of changed since 2016. How has he kind of evolved, either as an organizer or just a personality within this kind of space?
In some respects, he hasn't. The basic ideology is still, by all counts, similar, rooted in ideas of Christian nationalism shaped by Cleon Skousen and the National Center for Constitutional Studies. One of the things that we started to see in terms of change in Bundy's thinking is that after the election, and they promoted kind of the stop the steal ideas that the election was fraudulent and all that kind of stuff that you saw taking place in the broader movement. As they were going through that process, you started seeing Bundy have more of what I think of as a social pessimism. He started expressing the idea that he didn't know if the system could be saved anymore. The logic of that being pushing in the direction of some need for a far-right revolution to bring it back to what they want. And this was really reflected in Oregon in creation of a committee within Central Oregon chapter of People's Rights to create a state in Eastern Oregon. So you started to see ideas advocating secession. And when they talked about this state, under the Constitution, there are processes you can go through to create a state, to create a new state and bring it into the United States. That's not what they were talking about. They started citing the Declaration of Independence, throwing out their right to abolish the existing form of government, to replace it with one that they deemed constitutional. And they've built out kind of a plan for how they would restructure it. And all the while they've been saying, we want to engage in these kinds of legislative activities and run people for office. But if we don't, we're going to have the state of Eastern Oregon as a fallback. And so I think that was reflective of the direction that Bundy was going in terms of that social pessimism, that sense that they're probably not going to get what they want through legal political means. They might need to move in a direction. And they make quite clear in their minutes to their meetings and such that they have a vision of some sort of conflagration with the federal government around this issue. So moving more in a revolutionary direction was one thing that has changed in Bundy and in his kind of on the ground operations. Another thing that has developed further since Malheur is building out the paramilitary concept that Bundy has had. And so at the time of the elections, like I was just talking about, that he spelled out his view that the system might not be salvageable anymore. He also articulated an idea of small, tight-knit cells, which is something that's got a long history in the far right, white supremacist movement and such, small paramilitary cells, but with an eye to having them be able to coalesce if needed for larger kinds of confrontations. And in Oregon, they facilitated this through building out an internal communications structure, a mix of, walkie-talkie type communications. They use Slack. They have used different kinds of SMS messaging to send out alerts. But it's been coupled with a building out of this concept of small paramilitary units that can then coalesce when they're needed for some sort of higher level confrontation. And so really that social pessimism, more revolutionary kinds of thinking, and, building out a paramilitary, at least the concept of it. We're not sure the degree to which they've built that out on the ground, though they promoted weapons trainings all along in their development as well. But those are some of the ways that Bundy has appeared to, and Bundy and People's Rights as well, have appeared to change over the course of their development.
And I know a couple years ago, Bundy had some video that came out, and Bundy was basically saying, we shouldn't celebrate these attacks on migrant workers and stuff. And then he went on to say a little bit, basically saying, if you think Antifa and BLM are your big enemies, then you're just foolish. And I think some people were starting to think maybe he shifted a little bit. I'm just curious your thoughts on that. It just seemed to be kind of in the moment. Because, I mean, when you look at the makeup of the people that are involved in the People's Rights Network, I mean, it's very clear this is like a Trumpian far-right movement.
Yeah, yeah. I think there were several things in their ideology that in how he saw things that kind of moved him temporarily in that direction, particularly kind of libertarian and individualist aspects of their nationalism. And I think also, you know, particularly when around the George Floyd protests and police racism protests, just the sheer brutality of the murder of George Floyd and that it was captured on film, I think resonated and reverberated somewhat through this movement. But if you look at the speech that he gave around when it started getting widely publicized that he was supporting BLM, and you still see that kind of reporting now, in that same speech, he doubled down on his dad's view that black folks were better off under slavery than they are today. And he also endorsed the idea, seemed to hint at the idea that it was George Soros that was behind BLM. As soon as there started to be protests and, for instance, some property was damaged, he really swung back into an anti-BLM position. And the position that he was staking out that I think was rooted in those individualist aspects of his national identity never really caught on broadly in his networks. You had at the same time, you know, not long after he was articulating that, he had folks that were one dude, Sean Anderson, that was at Mahir with him, and then was a 3%er, was involved in mobilizing against BLM protests to try to stop Antifa from all the evil that they thought they were going to do. So I think that some of the same ideas that brought him into conflict in Malheur around the COVID stuff also played a role in kind of temporarily shifting him to mouth support for immigrants and BLM. But the fundamental ideology never changed. The radical assault on federal civil rights enforcement never changed. Their overall Christian nationalism never changed. And you saw this broadly across the militia movement where, as you know, the horror images of George Floyd being murdered became widely viewed, there were folks in Oath Keepers, for instance, that expressed some sympathy with that. As soon as the first window was broken in a protest, this movement pretty much universally swung back to the kind of far-right reaction that never left. I mean, that was always there. But I think that there were aspects of their ideology that had them temporarily support that. For instance, one of his lead activists, Kelly Stewart in Southern Washington, one of people's rights most prolific activists, other than possibly B.J. Soper in Oregon, she gives speeches about how Leonard Peltier and Yuri Call are both the same kind of victims of federal tyranny. You know, Peltier involved in AIM, taking a stand to try to defend the very real sovereignty of tribes. Yuri Call, a Christian identity advocate whose beef with the federal government was wanting to be involved in creating a whites-only township. They lump those together, and so you can see them swing back and at times sound like they're sympathetic with people of color that face this kinds of things, but they always swing back towards the kind of reaction and their staunch opposition to any government role in enforcing civil rights, economic equality, you know, even in minimal ways. So it's complicated when you get into their ideology, but over the course of that, the ideology didn't change. Its threat to democracy never changed. Its threat to civil rights and economic inequality, gender equality, never altered. It's, you know, there was kind of the old adage that even a broken clock is right twice a day. Parts of their ideology brought them in that direction, but the totality of it swung them back and will always swing them back towards threatening civil rights.
Well, if I remember correctly, I think the, you know, his statements about, you know, migrants, he was largely saying to somebody that worked in the agriculture industry, of course, he's around a lot of, you know, migrant farm workers. And he was saying, look, these people work hard and they're just here to help their family. So, which is interesting because I feel like there's been a lot of that where a lot of people, even though they have been voted for Trump, still realize that their entire industry depends on, you know, so-called undocumented labor. And that if, you know, you take that away and you actually have to make them pay livable wages, then they're going to be totally screwed.
Kind of the range of debate on the right in immigration is, you know, let's bring immigrants here to exploit their labor. To the other side of it, which is they pose a racial cultural threat and we need to expel them.
Right.
There's never, you know, let's even go to the level of making laws governing trade unions for migrant workers the same as other unions. You don't see that. You don't say, well, let's, you know, maybe we could work towards folk having worker cooperatives to do agriculture.
Right.
You don't see that. You don't see we're going to stand with our union brothers and sisters and make sure they have good wages, health care, clothes on their back, food, and a place to live that's decent.
Right. Yeah. Which would actually force wages to go up collectively for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or let's make it so you can't, you know, even at a minimal level where you're not changing structures, let's make it so no one can be paid less than $15 an hour. You know, a basic thing like that. They're not, they're, in fact, when you look at, say, the writings of, Cleon Skousen, Kelly Stewart in Southern Washington, things that Amon Bundy has said, things like a minimum wage would be an egregious breach of the rights of a property owner to use their property as they want to see fit.
Right. So, for sure.
Yeah, that's where their roots are, and that's what they come back to.
Well, just to turn back to the Klamath Basin, how did the People's Rights Network kind of show up in the situation, and what have kind of how have they been intervening? I know they've had some sort of like encampment set up or like little info tents and stuff like that, almost kind of like a right wing Occupy type situation.
Yeah, absolutely. So Grant Knoll, who sits on the Klamath Irrigation District, and Dan Nielsen, who is a ally of his, were both involved in 2001 in actually breaking in and opening up the spigots in violation of laws, which caused problems for, you know, water access to tribes. Well, both of them went in and purchased a piece of property right next to the Canal A head gates, where they would have to go in and, if they wanted to open them. And they both said they were doing it so the feds couldn't keep them away from the area, or at least I think it was Knowles that said that. Knowles has said they're gonna breach it at some point. And so that became that location, because both Grant Knowles and Dan Nielsen were allies of Bundy's, you started seeing signs showing up saying that Amon Bundy was coming. And that became what they call the Water Crisis Info Center, that is run by Kristen Jarvey Clark, who is a people's rights area assistant. And so it became a staging ground for people's rights events. And they started bringing in speakers to try to gather some momentum, various conspiracy theorists. There's one speaking tonight, Maggie Rose McGrath, who also goes by the name Denise Jansen Smith, is speaking there tonight. And she's a writer for the American Freedom Press, or the, what's it called? All these names start to sound the same. The American Free Press, which is the descendant of Willis Carto's Spotlight, which was a leading white nationalist publication, and founded the Populist Party. He used it to found the Populist Party, which was Klan, neo-Nazi, Christian Identity, etc. So they brought in speakers like this to try to build momentum. She's actually not speaking there. She's speaking at another site that People's Rights Oregon has used. But they set up this info center to try to build a base of support for Bundy and company breaching the head gates there and doing their propaganda and their local recruitment. But they've done it with the support of Grant Noel, who sits on the Klamath Irrigation District Board. So they've built, you know, some of that local alliance with local levels of government that's allowed them to do that. So that's where they inserted themselves and you know, set up some place that they could hold their meetings and bring in speakers and try to generate public support. So far, they haven't built a strong base in the community there, and we're hoping to keep it that way.
If this is the season to harvest, we harvest what we have grown. Our teeth like daggers, our nails sharpened on stone. There's a symmetry in the cycle, the land and the seasons are weapons of our survival. Of arrows, lightning crashing down. We've gone to war with empty hands before. With darkness, our Mother Earth, we stand the sacred ground.
Talk to us about how there's really like an anti-indigenous kind of component to this. And like you were saying before, there's like a movement that's been around for a while that's like kind of part and parcel to like this wider far-right ideology, but it seeks to roll back native sovereignty and like treaty rights and like, especially in this instance, water rights. And, Bundy has kind of echoed a lot of these sentiments, but there are people that like kind of have built a career off of this. Kind of explain who these players are and like, what is their ideology and what do they want to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, the most prominent, individual and group that has had a relationship with what they're doing is called the Center or Citizens Equal Rights Alliance, and Elaine Willman, who was a longtime leader of that group. She was a board member for a long time. She was board chair for a long time and then later a board member. And this is an organization that came out of the organized anti-Indian movement, which really, as tribes started to assert more sovereignty and build up a legal infrastructure to assert some of their rights and begin to press those rights, beginning in the 40s and 50s, and particularly coming after the assault on tribes in the Termination era in the 1950s, in the 60s and 70s, as tribes really started to build up a capacity to try to assert their inherent right to govern their own lands and resources, and an organized anti-Indian movement began. And it began in reservations here in Washington and in Montana were some of the first places that it was sparked. Citizens Equal Rights Alliance emerged in the 1980s as kind of a clearinghouse on this stuff. To produce papers, hold conferences, engage in activism. And their goals are quite explicitly to terminate all tribes, to end the federal relationship with tribes, to abrogate all treaties, to end all treaties under which water rights and fishing rights are reserved. And treaties never gave anything to tribes. They reserved rights that they had, from time immemorial. And really to end tribal nationhood, to continue the assault on tribes that, was really foundational to American society. And so this movement has, been around since that time. It's taken a lot of different forms. At times it's had relationships with power. Washington State Senator and former Attorney General Slade Gorton was really tight with this movement in his efforts to end tribal sovereignty. Been around for a while. This movement has also had a relationship with Bundy and his crowd. Amon Bundy spoke at a meeting with Elaine Willman. Bundy came right out and said at the start of this Klamath conflict, when a reporter from Talking Points Memo, I think it was, raised the issue of tribal rights in this context and context, and Bundy said, "Yeah, those are great liberal talking points." So that's an idea compatible with the anti-Indian movement. It's an idea that put him on a stage with Elaine Willman. Debbie Bacha Galupi, who is a far-right conspiracy theorist, particularly the Agenda 21 conspiracy of a UN takeover of property, out of their, fairly innocuous Agenda 21 program from the early 90s, wholly voluntary program. She also has had a relationship with Elaine Willman. She is the moderator for the Klamath Basin Crisis Facebook page. Klamath Basin Crisis has been a clearinghouse of information going back to the early days, back to 2000 and the early water conflicts that, in the region that stretch back. Well, they have a page, for people that want to learn about tribes, and it's called Ask Elaine, and it's Elaine Willman. It's this leader of SERA. Kristen Jarvie Clark, the people's rights activist that is the head of their Water Crisis Info Center, right there adjacent to Canal A, is also a member of Klamath Basin Crisis, the group that sends people to Elaine Willman. And it sends people to Citizens Equal Rights Alliance. So there are these, clearly these clear connections between the two. There's a nexus of ideas. Just the fact of going in and wanting to breach the canal and divert that water away from Klamath Lake and the downstream area poses a dire threat to tribal rights. And it shows, too, how the Citizens Equal Rights Alliance works. They're not really a mass-based organization that does a lot of on-the-ground activism now. They engage in litigation, friend of the court briefs, but they also are just a plug-in for far-right groups that run into an issue with tribes. They've been a plug-in for the John Birch Society, Tea Party groups. Elaine Willman defended basically Eamon Bundy's 2016 Malheur actions. And they've plugged into this struggle through Klamath Basin Crisis, through a relationship with Eamon Bundy, and through Christian Jarvie Clark's role as a member of Klamath Basin Crisis, that they're continuing to play that plug-in role for far-right groups that run into tribal issues. Tribal law is a convoluted mess rooted in settler colonialism. And Sarah and Elaine Willman put themselves forward as experts so that when people need to argue for terminating a tribal right, they can kind of plug in and reach out to Sarah. And that's what's taken place down there. We did an article just looking at the anti-Indian aspects of their mobilization. And it's a radical, radical assault on inherent tribal sovereignty, water rights, and treaty rights.
How do you see global warming and just everything that's happening right now on the West Coast? I mean, we're seeing this huge drought. We're seeing record-breaking temperatures again for another summer. Obviously, climate change is all a part of this. I mean, whether they're talking about that or not, I mean, this is all kind of like part and parcel to this larger kind of issue. How do you see this kind of like exacerbating or impacting the far right, like as we go forward?
Yeah, I do. I think it will in two ways that I can kind of think of. One is it's just, you know, these kind of drought situations, just the fact that climate change is going to exacerbate those, potentially increase their frequency and severity, and so create the kind of contexts that we're seeing in Southern Oregon, and that, you know, we really need to come up with longer term solutions to address those that aren't dependent on that are going to take into account the realities of potentially dwindling water resources, ecological restoration and all that. So there's the real material kinds of impacts that it's going to have on the ground. But there's also, so for instance, Debbie Bacigalupi, who People's Rights just brought up to speak at their meeting, promotes the Agenda 21 conspiracy, that this project that was done by the United Nations, 187 countries signed on to it, to address sustainability, particularly in developing countries, and some language around addressing poverty, that this is seen as a conspiracy against property rights by folks like Bacigalupi, and one in particular that involves tribes and the feds cooperating with the UN to take land through federal Indian policies. And if you look at how Bacigalupi finds evidence that Agenda 21 conspiracy is underfoot, is when local planning bodies use words like sustainability. So you can imagine that as we confront the realities of climate change, local governing bodies and state, you know, entities that try to address this are going to have to think about sustainable development practices. For folks in this movement, that's going to potentially ratchet up for the evidence for them that a satanic conspiracy is underfoot. And so at the same time that the material conditions are going to be made more difficult, measures to address it are going to probably be interpreted by folks in this movement as part of the satanic globalist conspiracy that they see themselves up against. So I wish I had a happier message, but you know, that's how I see some of that playing out, both exacerbating the ecological realities that we got to address and potentially exacerbating, the, as entities try to address it, the conspiracy think that is part and parcel of this far right brand of nationalism that we're seeing.
Well, anything else you want to say? And also, do you want to plug anything? How can people follow the work that you're doing?
Yeah, you can follow us on irehr.org is our website. We're on Twitter and Facebook as well. If you research, search irehr.org. We also have an app on our website that you can link to that we will get soon have up and running to send out alerts about meetings and background information, and that you can also use to communicate with us and send us stuff that you see in the community as well, a way to keep in touch and figure out how to address some of these issues. And I think it's just, you know, this stuff takes research and exposure, you know, that y'all do a great job on and a great deal of work around. It takes building out our coalitions, you know, for justice and developing specific strategies to try to marginalize these groups within our broader struggle for economic and racial and gender justice. And I think another thing that we have to do, and you see the importance of this in the Klamath Basin, is often in our movements, economic issues and civil rights issues are understood better than our tribal treaty rights and sovereignty issues. So I think there's a need to work in our own movements to foster better understandings of that and build alliances with tribes. You know, raising global warming, tribes are critical in the fight to really address some of the climate change issues that we're seeing. And I don't think we can, you know, heal this land and move in a better direction without fully recognizing and supporting the rights of tribes. And I think our own movements could be better informed on that and be good allies. So that's some of the parting messages I would leave, and that, you know, we stand on the backs of giants in the struggle for human rights in this country, and we just got to continue to fight and try to make this world a better place.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.